Welcome to What in God's Name. He's Chris Owen.
And she is Shana Appel. We welcome you to 25 minutes of moral and theological calisthenics.
Nice.
But before we get into the meat of today's show...
Does that make us the Jack LaLanne of podcasts?
I don't know who that is.
You're kidding me, right? You've never heard of Jack LaLanne.
Remember, I'm a dork.
Oh my God. How old are you?
12.
Yeah, okay. Hopefully some of our listeners have heard of Jack LaLanne, or that's going to have really fallen flat. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Shana. We're doing theological and philosophical reflections on current events and culture, and today is our coronavirus edition. Briefly, we have other things to get to. I went into the supermarket, and I actually found hand sanitizer.
Yeah, I can't wait to shake somebody's hand and, you know, take a little sniff and go, Grey Goose? Who knows what people are into these days.
The other thing I wanted to share lightheartedly about this is that my cousin posted on Facebook the message from the CDC. To prevent coronavirus, stay home, avoid physical contact, and don't go into large crowds. Introvert response. I've been preparing for this moment my whole life, which I love because I'm an introvert, even though I do this show and I enjoy people.
Yeah, it's sort of like the ultimate snow day, right? That goes on for a couple of weeks. But in the strain of theological responses to coronavirus, a friend of mine had posted something by Abdu Sharkway, who's a doctor and an infectious disease specialist who's been working at this for two decades in some of the most troubled corners of the world and the United States. And he says that he's not scared of COVID-19. What he's scared about is the loss of reason and the wave of fear that has induced the masses of society into a spellbinding spiral of panic, stockpiling obscene quantities of anything that could fill a bomb shelter adequately in a post-apocalyptic world. He reflected that what he's mostly scared about is the message we're sending our kids in terms of how we behave when faced with a threat. Instead of reason, he writes, rationality, open-mindedness, and altruism, we're telling them to panic, be fearful, suspicious, reactionary, and self-interested. It's easy to be a person of faith when the waters are still. It's when the waters get troubled that really digging into who we are and what we're made of is tested. These are the trials. And I was also thinking of that short passage in light of what we're talking about today, your visit down to Andover Newton Seminary at Yale Divinity School.
Shana sent me on assignment to have a conversation with Professor Mark Heim. Our conversation was about forgiveness, not just interpersonal forgiveness, but forgiveness in a group setting. Forgiveness in society at large. You will hear in this conversation, Mark references Martin Nowak, a Harvard professor who does computer models of evolutionary biology. Mark likes to bring together science and theology. So for those of you who really like that kind of thinking, that cross-disciplinary thinking, this is a good show for you.
Just one word to our listeners. I was fortunate enough to have Professor Heim as one of my teachers while I was at Andover Newton. Mark is an abstract thinker, an absolute brilliant individual who I think in some ways, I oftentimes found myself confused listening to him. But on the other hand, sometimes confusion and not knowing is a great way to approach God. So if you find yourselves listening to this interview, and you guys all know that Chris is a fairly abstract thinker, so allowing the two of these individuals to be in a room together probably wasn't the smartest move I've ever made. But there they are. Here's the interview. Listen with a soft focus and enjoy the trip.
We are with Mark Heim. Mark is the Samuel Abbott Professor of Christian Theology at Andover Newton Seminary at Yale Divinity School. Mark, thank you for taking some time.
Oh, my pleasure, Chris. Thanks for being here.
One of the premises of our show is that we believe that theological language, theological categories, theological ways of thinking and framing the world can be helpful to people to try to make sense of where we are as a culture, as a society. And so I was wondering about your current thinking about grace and tit for tat, and just help us understand what your thinking is on that, and then we'll draw some connections to the culture and to the society that we're in.
Well, obviously grace is a big topic, and I've been involved in it in general for a long time, but I've gotten very interested in a specific version of grace, a specific application of grace, which is the whole question of forgiveness. And I think this does have application to our current context and situation, which we can kind of circle back to. But my interest in forgiveness kind of starts at a very traditional place, which is we most often think about that in a very intimate, interpersonal way. Like one person hurts another person, the other person does or doesn't find a way to forgive them. And what's interesting is that, I'd say really just 25 or 30 years or so now, there's been a lot of intensive research and investigation of that. I mean, before that, forgiveness was a theological topic almost entirely, or maybe a little bit psychological, but it never really occurred to anyone that you might do like lab experiments on it. But there is this whole genre of investigation, some of it quasi-medical, even medical people saying, well, your better health outcomes when people are able to let go of their feelings of woundedness and find a way of healing. And obviously psychological investigations, this is oftentimes framed in terms of individual wellness, right? The benefit to the one who's forgiving, which is in a way, right, different from the theological tradition that tended to say, well, you did this not for your own sake, mainly you did it for the sake of your neighbor or for in faithfulness to God. But whereas now this focus is very much on, there's an objective, self-interested reason you should be involved in forgiveness because it will be good for you in the long run. So I was interested in that because it seemed like, in terms of your podcast, the whole theme, here's a theological topic that's kind of migrated into the general, people who don't go to church would say, well, I'm going to forgiveness workshops, you know, or I've trying to work on my forgiveness muscles so I can be more healthy and more self-realized. So I just found that fascinating. And it was from that I kind of stumbled into this other dimension of thinking about forgiveness, which I did not see coming, really, which is the whole much less individual and much more social, much evolution-based, kind of humans in groups, and what role this might play in our sort of wider networks of relationship. So I can go in that direction if you... That's where the tit-for-tat...
Yeah, go kind of say about in. That, yes.
Yeah, so...
I mean, is tit-for-tat something like the lex talionis? I mean, is it?
Yes. It doesn't take a lot of your junior high schoolyard will produce you did it to him, he should have a chance to do it to you. It's a rough idea of justice is that what goes around comes around. You should get what you deal out. And so it turns out that has a kind of specific application in the whole realm of evolutionary theory. In theory, evolution is about the survival of those who do the best job in surviving. So there's kind of selfishness built into the equation. So it's always been a question for evolutionists about altruism. Is there any place for altruism? And they usually think about that in a positive sense, doing a benefit or a good to some other agent. So they get something you don't get. You give up something for them. Which makes no evolutionary sense. Why should that be? Why should people who do that still be around, or their descendants still be around? So it produced a lot of interesting reflection, where they say, "Well, maybe it's extended selfishness. So you do something for somebody else in the hopes they'll do something back for you, and in the end, you'll come out at least even, or maybe a little bit ahead. That's kind of reciprocal altruism. Or you do it for your kin, right? So you're willing to." Parents are willing to sacrifice for their children because they're your genes, right? And they're going to get into the next generation. And I'm pushing it now a little bit myself, but I'd much rather see my kids healthy and reproducing than me doing that. So they develop a whole kind of string of reasons why your individual organism wouldn't put itself first, but it might put some other people first occasionally. And out to the kind of outer boundary of saying what these people call reputational altruism. Like, I do something nice for you, not in, in a small group. We might all be keeping track. I did something good for you, and have you done something good for me recently? And I won't keep doing something good for you if you don't. But now the group has gotten too big for me to keep track of everybody in my mind. So all I need to know now is, are you a member of my group? And if you are, I'll do something good for you in the expectation that maybe not you, but somebody else who knows I'm a good person who does that will do a good thing for me. So I'd say that's where, in a kind of science world, that's the outer boundary of what they would say is real in terms of altruism.
And those theories came from evolutionary biologists.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, just trying to say, well, how do we explain behavior that doesn't seem to correspond to our selfishness, organism first, kind of mentality? But here's the interesting part. Taking a long time to get to this, but there's an evolutionary biologist, not really a mathematical biologist at Harvard named Martin Nowak. And he took this example that many people may be familiar with, the prisoner's dilemma, which is, I don't know why it started out with this idea, but two people are arrested for a crime they committed. If one person turns on the other, they get a lighter sentence. If they both turn on each other, they both get the worst outcome. But if you're the fink and the other person isn't, you get a better outcome than they do. Now, if you both don't give up the other, you make it the best outcome for both of you. But the dilemma is, what do you do? If you could be a chump, if the other person turns you and you don't turn them in. But what Nowak did was he turned this into a mathematical model and said, this is a little bit like what goes on in the human world if you think it's not a one-time event. Like I have people I interact with on a regular basis. And so on a daily basis, you might be a jerk toward me, or you might be good guy toward me. The things that we just talked about, reciprocal altruism or reputational altruism, all those things are kind of in play. But his question was, what's the best strategy? What's the best strategy? And they could do this now by kind of running computer simulations, and you can, have thousands of iterations of this. So what works best? And initially, their conclusion was what works best is tit for tat. By working best now, we just mean like selfishly gives you the best result in the long run. So when you have constant interactions with a group of people, what's the best strategy to adopt? And they said, well, it's whatever they do to you, you should do back to them. If you're more generous than that, you get screwed. And if you're more punitive than that, you also get screwed because people don't like you. No, the Lex Talonis was right. You kind of hit the sweet spot. But here's where it gets particularly interesting to me is that's assuming that everybody has perfect knowledge about everything. I really do know what you did to me the last time, right? Or what you intended to do or so on. But in the real world, Nowak said, it isn't like that. We really don't know always who did what, why, to whom. So he said, when you put that into the system, when you put a certain amount of uncertainty in, it turns out tit for tat isn't the best strategy. The best strategy is what he called generous tit for tat. And that's when every once in a while, when the other person has done the bad thing to you, has defected from you, you just gratuitously don't hold it against them. You still behave well toward them. And it works better because tit for tat locks people in a death spiral, right? Once you've done something bad to me and I decided I'm going to do something back to you, and if you follow the same law, which is the best strategy, then we'll do nothing but negative things to each other to infinity. And he said, then that means you both will get worse outcomes than you would if somebody had broken the cycle. So generous tit for tat actually leads to people having better outcomes. Well, all of a sudden, forgiveness has sort of floated into the room in a certain way. That unmerited generosity, it has nothing to do with what they deserve or someone. It's just, let's not get into that. Can we get out of this spiral? Can we get out of this death trap? Let's just test and see if we can. So I found that really interesting. But it's this little computer world, and that's obviously highly simplified or so, and yet it has certain features that seem to be real in many ways. So the more he got into this, the more he found that you can kind of cycle through generations, and in a group, in a society, we might say, of these programs interacting with each other, it waxes and wanes. So generous tit for tat will win, but that means it averages out to be best over a long period of time. But the actual community kind of goes through cycles where generous tit for tat is working, and when that happens, the community gets more and more generous. That is to say, people, they insert their generous act more often. Initially, maybe they were every 5 or 6 times when somebody does something bad to you, you don't respond. But when everybody's behaving more generously, then it's to your benefit to be generous more often. And so it is a kind of virtuous spiral where the group becomes more and more generous.
And it sounds like, I mean, that is a model where an individual choice can then affect the wider whole.
Yeah. And so he doesn't say this, but so in a way, the meek do inherit the earth for a while. But after a while, when it gets really, really generous, when the strategy to get, you get the best return by being more generous than your neighbor, because everybody's being generous back, that's a great field for a defector to enter. And at that point, the selfish program begins to succeed more and more and more and more. And all of a sudden, the collective gets more and more tit for tattish, or even maybe, you know, two tits for a tat. So the whole system can become really quite virulent. But he says, but then in that, when people are being really, really negative, then the generous tit for tat like reasserts itself, and now we go back to this. So I found that so interesting, because in that way, that focus on forgiveness as a very interpersonal thing, this is a very impersonal thing, because it's talking about, it's how you behave to people who maybe you never have met or don't know well, right, in this kind of social interaction. And I think there seems to be a lot of evidence for that in societies, we would say, are societies that are doing well, you know, Denmark, or, you know, over a certain period of time, where there's kind of a sense of close-knit harmony, identity, but people don't necessarily know each other individually. They just know that you're a Dane, or, you know, or you're part of this community, and I just treat you in a certain way because of that, because I've learned to expect that you'll treat me a certain way. And so it does seem to correspond to things that actually happen.
I'm struck by the theology of that, too. And I'm not going to use theological terms, but the virtuous cycle of that just kind of feeds this overflowing generosity for a time.
Yeah, right.
Which seems to me.
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, we have these teachings in our religious traditions that they don't commend forgiveness as an instrumental strategic. I mean, there may be a little element of that. This, do this and it will be good for you and your house. But generally, it's a universal principle. You should treat everyone this way. And what's fascinating to me is that the evolutionary biologists would say, well, really, this is all about groups, right? That the outer boundary is you want to behave this way to those who are part of your group, but not toward people who are part of another group. And they would say the religious teachings were a way of kind of weaning people or teaching people not to just be altruistic toward their kin. If you're going to function in a wider human group, you're going to have to extend that. And so religion taught people to have this kind of reputational altruism. You know, I'll do it to you because you belong to my church, because you're part of you believe the same God. But it's interesting to me but that isn't the teaching. The teaching in the Jewish or a Christian is everyone. You should forgive everyone. Now, the biologist might say, well, you can't hit that near target, the group, unless you're shooting at something that's bigger, that our minds can, like, what universal means everything I can kind of see from where I'm standing. As a religious person, as a Christian, I tend to think, no, it may be the other way around. The evolutionary perspective has kind of caught on to 30% of the of what the commandment is about, but we haven't negotiated that transition to what it means to belong to a universal group as well as we have the transition to what it means to belong to a group I can, well, you wear the cross, and so, well, now I know. You know, there's something that markers, and that's what the evolutionary biologist would say. Yeah, you have to have a way to identify who should be within this circle.
So, Chris, most often when we think about forgiveness, we think about it in terms of person to person, and Mark is going well beyond that into a this broader sense of corporate forgiveness and how it impacts sort of the flavor, the tenor, the color of society.
I was really intrigued by this idea that the feeling of a society can change based on whether people are doing this generous tit for tat. So returning bad things that somebody does to you with forgiveness, and how that can be like multiplied out into the society, and it transforms the feeling of society, and that that gets to a certain point where somebody says, oh, I can gain advantage by for myself if I take advantage of those who are forgiving all the time. And so then you have somebody who injects this kind of selfishness back into the system, and then people are like, oh, wait a minute, if I forgive, I'm a sucker because people are taking advantage of me. And so the society then goes through this cycle of cycling back to what Mark is calling tit for tat, this kind of, you know, if you're bad to me, I'm going to be bad to you. And so the vision is of societies that move in these cycles of growing generosity until somebody kind of says, oh, wait a minute, I can take advantage of that. And then it pulls back into and back and forth into from selfishness to generosity to selfishness to generosity.
And I, to the extent that I actually understood that vision, you know, I was thinking it might be really interesting to take a historic timeline and try to lay over that where different cultures were in that cycle. Because I think about times like post-World War II and how in America, and I think this was also true elsewhere, you know, we had just been through a world war. And I think, you know, that's kind of the place after which people sort of step back and go, whoa. And so there, it seems to me there was a whole lot more altruism then. And now we're in the tit for tat time. But the comfort is knowing that this has a natural cycle. We're going to come out of this at some point. I mean, that's at least the hope for me.
Yeah, I think that's the hope that's identified in that model. What it takes is a courageous person or courageous people who are going to break that cycle of tit for tat and respond with generosity.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, I'm thinking of the passage about, you know, the seed that lands on rock. This is the passage in Scripture where Jesus is telling the story about, he's using seed as a metaphor. He's saying, look, you know, I mean, there's seed that grows on rock. It's going to blow away. Nothing's going to happen there. Then there's the seed that falls into, you know, the thistle. And it may start to grow, but then it's going to get choked out. And then, of course, there's the seed that lands in good soil and sprouts root. It's almost like both the tit for tat and the cultures of generosity only need to find fertile ground in order to grow. And since we are that fertile ground, the question is, which seed are we willing to entertain? Because that is a choice.
I love the metaphor. Shana, any agricultural metaphor you want to use is good with me. I was anticipating that metaphor of the soil, and the question comes how we prepare the soil, how we prepare the soil so that we can grow the plant that flowers as generosity, as forgiveness, as grace. That's part of what we're about on this show with our core values: be curious, go deep, shine light. Those are the habits.
Yes. Certainly the staying curious, the going deep and shining light, especially where that leads to sort of, you know, those deeper conversations, those conversations that get under the political mishigas that's out there these days, as awful and hideous as most of it is. So, yeah, I mean, I certainly hope that we're a part of that. And I think the extent to which people can engage some self-care of the spirit, taking those timeouts, putting ourselves in front of awe and wonder, giving ourselves opportunities to grow right-sized. When we're doing something for someone, to not objectify them, but to partner, to come up alongside of them. You know, these are all ways that we can become that fertile ground.
Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine light. I wanted to remind everyone that we are in the middle of our fund drive appeal. We have received a $1,000 challenge grant, so any new or increase in donation will be matched 100%. So if you give $50, think of it as though you have given $100. And to make this easy for you, go to our website, whatingods.com. That's whatingods. G-O-D-S. And on the landing page, you will find two buttons. First button is Patreon. You'll land on our Patreon page. And the second button is Filmmakers Collaborative, our fiscal sponsor. The bonus of donating through Filmmakers Collaborative is that you will get from our fiscal sponsor a recognition of your donation for tax purposes. That was a mouthful.
Yeah, it always is. Chris.
So good to be with you, Shayna.
Terrific to be with you. Enjoy the day, and I hope you finish up your boiling of all the sap you've gathered up from your trees, and that it is just sweet, sweet, sweet.
There is a sweetness in it, Shayna.
Absolutely.
See you next time.
Next time.
Stay tuned next week for part two of our conversation with Mark Heim.